Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's June the 3rd, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Okay, guys, before we get on with my usual ranting and raving, I need a quick word in your shell-like ears about something. Back in March, one of our people here in the Seattle metro area got a surreptitious visit from our friends in the silk suits, or rather his landlady did, and they were able to persuade her to let them into his apartment when he wasn't there for what's known in the trade as a sneak and peek. And yes, that is now perfectly legal under the Patriot Act. All they need is a ruling from a U.S. attorney that their investigation involves quote-unquote terrorism, and then it's constitution. What constitution? Basically, the Patriot Act simply formalizes the way the organs have already been treating us for years. The way we found out about this is that apparently our comrade is such a nice guy, and the landlady felt so bad about betraying him to the secret police that she broke down and confessed to him. Don't know how long the droids were in there, or what they did while they were inside. They may have installed some kind of spyware on our guy's computer, although since almost all of what he does on his computer ends up being published on the internet anyway, I'm not sure if I see the point. I guess it made them feel like real-life James Bond-type spies or whatever. Our guy assures me that he doesn't look at porno sites, so whoever's monitoring his computer is probably in for a very boring time, just like whoever's monitoring mine. I feel I should mention this, though, just to let people know that, yes, surprise, surprise, the Northwest Front is on the enemy radar, and also, in light of my personal rant towards the end of last week's broadcast, maybe a somewhat more calm and methodical commentary on dealing with these hoods might be in order. First off, we tend to give the organs credit for a lot more subtlety than they in fact possess. You have to bear in mind that federal law enforcement personnel are not actually real cops. What they are is what was called apparatchiks in the old Soviet Union, parts of an apparatus. They're basically bureaucrats and careerists with badges and guns, and this is the key to understanding them. Now, these people make their careers, get their promotions, get their cushy postings to New York or D.C. or Hawaii or wherever they want to go, not just through the usual bureaucratic ass-kissing and intrigue, but through racking up arrests and convictions, whether of guilty or innocent people doesn't really matter. They literally build their careers on human bodies and the destruction of people's lives, and in order to score their brownie points with the Bureau or whoever, they have to do it openly and by the book so that they get credit and it goes in their personnel jacket. That means that when they're just creeping around like this, they're usually just messing with you. If they actually have any excuse to arrest anybody, they'll almost always go ahead and do it. Now, this stuff you see on TV about the FBI weaving all these complex stings and stuff is crap. They do that stuff on occasion, yes, but only for really major busts. That thing they did in Michigan a few months ago appears to be kind of low rent, although I know it doesn't appear like that to the poor bastards who have had their lives destroyed. The informer is some woman who apparently was so incompetent that she lost all her notes and couldn't remember anything of importance on the witness stand in the preliminary hearing. But usually, the FBI and BATFE especially prefer a bird in the hand to two in the bush, and if they catch somebody doing something stupid, they'll make a quick bust and rack up a few quick brownie points. They won't browbeat someone's landlady into letting them peek into your home and root through your stuff. They'll just kick in the door in full body armor, yelling and screaming and terrorizing children and what they generally do to convince themselves and others that they're big, tough badasses. Now, if they don't do that, then that means they haven't got anything on you, and you really don't need to be afraid of them so long as you yourself don't do something really stupid and walk right into their waiting arms. Most of the people they get because their victims walked into it or were seduced into it by informants, like that Michigan militia thing. For that reason, and also because someone forgets the five words, which I will get into in a minute. When you really need to be worried is not when they're creeping around and sneaking into your home trying to plant spy software on your computer, but when you've got somebody on your own team who won't shut up about illegal activity and who's pretty clearly trying to talk people into breaking the law. That is a warning signal you don't dare ignore. A minor sneak and peek, like what happened to our guy a couple of months ago, is most likely what federal employees call a budget burner. And once you're on their radar, they're going to use you for that purpose, to burn budget. What you have to understand about our lord and masters in federal law enforcement, and indeed anyone who works in any federal or state government department, is in bureaucratic circles, it's all about budget. Your department's cut of the taxpayer pie. Now, a lot of what the FBI, BTFE, DHS, Secret Service, NSA, CIA do, etc., is designed to justify their existence, even better, to justify their existence at the expense of all those other agencies in the federal alphabet soup. Above all, they need to justify their immense budgets to the bean counters back in Washington, D.C. Now, whoever gets the big budget has to spend that money or look bad. If you're thrifty and you actually save the government money and you bring in your department under budget, then what they'll do is they'll cut your allocation for the next fiscal year, and that's no way for an FBI career man to build an empire. I read a memoir by an FBI agent once, and he described how on a slow day his SAIC, Special Agent in Charge, would walk through the office yelling at people, "Why aren't you guys out in the field catching bad guys? Come on, boys and girls, we still got $200,000 worth of budget this office has to burn before July the 1st. Hit the road and let me see some expense vouchers." That kind of thing. This is essentially what happened to Randy Weaver back in 1992. The FBI decided they were going to turn him as an informer to spy on the Aryan nations, but Randy refused. Rather than taking no for an answer, some special agent got pissed off at the stroppy white boy who wouldn't do as he was told by his betters and started harassing Randy, trying to coerce him into becoming an informer, up to and including such things as rigging up fiber optic cameras in the trees around his cabin to spy on him and framing him on a sawed-off shotgun charge, which the Bureau now admits that they did. Rare for them. All the while, this special agent in charge from the Spokane FBI office, I think, was spending money, budget money, on Randy and building up a file with no court case and no conviction. And finally, he was told by Washington that he'd spent too much money and he damn well better come up with a conviction for something, which led to the attack on the Weaver's home and the murder of his wife and son. Sam and Vicky Weaver died for some FBI agent's bottom line. Another thing about these little visits we may get from our friends in the silk suits, a lot of what they're trying to accomplish is to build up potential networks of informants by finding people who will talk to them at all about anything. Sports, weather, politics, doesn't matter, because that leads to other stuff. When the organs show up at your door for the first time, they're scoping you out as a potential snitch simply by asking you a few innocuous questions about nothing in particular. Your answers to those questions are not so important in themselves as the fact that you answer them at all. And if you do, the first time they leave, they will mark you down in their little notebook and their files as a potential source, as someone who will talk to them. And that's what you don't want, because once you establish that you will talk to them about anything, then they're going to keep coming back looking for more and more information about more and more people. They especially love to locate smart-ass right-winger types, shithouse lawyers, who want to show off how clever they are and how much they know about the Constitution and the law and who will run their mouths to prove that point, which of course they aren't. Smart, that is. Federal agents are, among other things, trained intelligence analysts. As long as the noise is coming out of your mouth, they will find some way to extract information from it, and they will use that information to destroy human lives, including your own. And yeah, I know that danger applies to these podcasts as well, but taking that risk is part of my job description, not yours. After all, it's what you pay me the big bucks for. I'll tell you what has worked for me in the past, so far at least. When federal agents come to your door and say that they want to ask you questions, the very first words out of your mouth must be, "Do you have a warrant?" If they try to bluster or BS you off the subject, repeat the question. Do you have a warrant? Do not allow them to evade that question. Say nothing else until they answer the question. And above all, do not let them in voluntarily. Do not let them go to the bathroom or get a drink of water or use the phone or anything like that. Because once they're inside, they will find some way to wander all over your home, sneaking and peeking. By way of full disclosure, the one time I have ever let the cops into my crib voluntarily was 7 years ago in Centralia, Washington, when three local police showed up at 11 o'clock at night and said they had a call that I was quote-unquote killing Jews in my apartment, and I invited them in to see for themselves that I didn't have any dead bodies under the bed, after which they apologized and left. They'd already figured out that it was a crank call, but they had to check it out. But that was a different situation from a federal fishing expedition. Now, if the agents do have a warrant, most likely they won't be knocking on the door anyway. They'll be kicking it down about dawn and screaming threats at you and throwing you on the floor and sticking automatic weapons in your back. Or more likely, hiding behind the local police SWAT team while they do it. Now, that one time I got visited a couple of years ago because I was making unkind remarks about the one on my blog, the Secret Service sent in a local police officer to interview me first. Now, if I had been some kind of violent nutcase with an apartment full of guns, the poor local boy would have caught it first while the mighty Secret Service cowered safely outside and could call for backup. The feds are very big on that, using local police as human shields. Now, getting back to the situation where you have a couple of droids standing on your doorstep, if they don't have a warrant, then you simply say, come back when you get one, and immediately close the door. That's important. Close the door. Don't stand there with it open waiting for them to go away. They won't go away. They'll try to engage you in further conversation and persuade you to invite them in so that they can sneak and peek. Do not give them any opportunity to say anything else. Once you have told them to come back with a warrant, close the door. If they force their way into your home without a warrant, which they can now legally do under the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, then is when the five words kick in. I have nothing to say. Do not try to bandy words or debate with them or show them how clever you are about the law and the Constitution. The FBI and the DHS know all about the Constitution. They simply choose to ignore it because they can. Don't try to tell them you have rights. Out here in the real world, you are a racially aware white man, and so no, you don't. They may try to verbally provoke you into assaulting them so that they can arrest you and have a charge to hold over your head. Don't fall for it. Answer every question with either I want an attorney or I have nothing to say. And then when your attorney arrives, you still have nothing to say. Remember, these people have one purpose only, and that is to do harm. The prisons are full of men and women who talked their way right into that cell because they had the idea that if they could just explain it all or whatever it is, then the cops or whatever would just go away and leave them alone and let them go home. It doesn't work like that. Five words. I have nothing to say. Those five words can save your life, literally. Human beings and human lives are the fuel, the fodder, the raw material on which an FBI agent or other federal investigator builds his career. His achievement is measured in years of prison time that other people have to serve, not him. So he really goes after those years, looking to pile them onto anyone he can so his record shines in Washington. A federal agent is not your friend. Never. Not under any circumstances. They are not interested in you. They are not interested in your life or your problems. They are not interested in you as a person at all. To them, you and your family are either targets to be destroyed or stepping stones they can use to build their careers and land that plush job at headquarters in Washington, D.C., or maybe in the Honolulu field office. And when the secret police show up on your doorstep, they are there for one reason only, to do harm. Either to you or someone else. You must never forget this, because if you do, you will pay for it in many, many years of living hell. All it takes is a few words coming out of your mouth to destroy your life and the lives of countless other people forever. The only way you can avoid that is to make sure that only five words ever come out of your mouth. I have nothing to say. Okay. On to another and somewhat less depressing topic. I'm going to revive the institution of the audio fireside chats for personal communication between myself and the people on the list who, in my view, need to hear what I have to say on certain topics. These will be a lot shorter than Radio Free Northwest because I intend to distribute them as MP3 attachments, and that means I have to keep them under 10 megabytes, i.e. about 7 or 8 minutes long. Most of these short monologues will be about internal Northwest front and movement matters, which aren't really suitable for general listening in an enemy-monitored environment. But when I was going through my backlog of old fireside chats, I came across a few of them that are, in fact, appropriate for general distribution. And what I think I'm going to do here is replay some of those short audio files as part of this episode of Radio Free Northwest, because this podcast has a much wider listening audience than the original list I distributed these things to, and most of the people listening to this podcast will not have heard these before. With my fancy new WavePad software, I can just drop them right in here. Now, this is Fireside Chat number 10 from back in December.
This is Harold Covington speaking, and the date is December the 9th, 2009. I apologize yet again for the sound of my voice. I'm still not over my annual dose of winter crud, but I promised this one couple about 10 days ago, before the crud set in, that I would address an issue of concern that they raised. It's something I think I need to go verbal on, and besides, I have another radio appearance tomorrow night, and I want to talk about this before then. Some of you on our contact list, especially new people who are conservative types coming in from the Tea Party scene, have expressed concern about the Northwest Front's approach on racial matters, and especially over the fact that I say the word nigger out loud, not to mention mungkoid, coon, beaner, spick, kike, hose nose, sheeny, red sea pedestrian, and all sorts of other colorful expressions to describe the avalanche of human garbage that has overrun what was once our home and was once a nation that was the pride and awe of humanity. Now, you're worried that these words I use don't sound respectable, and you're right, they don't. There is a reason for that. I am not respectable, nor have I ever aspired to be. Revolutionaries, by definition, are never respectable. In this diseased and putrid society, the only rightful and appropriate place for any white man or woman with the slightest remaining jot of pride, integrity, or self-respect is on the wrong side of the law and the wrong side of the establishment. Now, we have to get rid of this idea that we're going to be able to change things in this filthy world and still maintain the approval of the PTA and the Chamber of Commerce and the Rotary Club. We have to get out of this sad, nostalgic belief that there is some kind of red, white, and blue solution to all this that will bring back the world of the Brady Bunch, and that we can do this while still being nice, respectable, middle-class American consumer animals. It ain't going to happen. As Lenin said, a revolution is not a tea party. His wasn't, and ours will not be. But there are sound political and psychological reasons as well, not just making a personal statement, for not caving in to political correctness in the matter of language. Now, some of you may have read George Orwell's classic novel 1984, and if you haven't, then you should go get a copy immediately. 1984 is required reading for anyone who wants to truly understand the nature of the world that we live in. Now, in that book, in the section on Newspeak, Orwell speaks of the abuse of language by government for the purpose of controlling thought. By reducing the number of words available in the English language that express certain political and moral concepts and ideas, an all-powerful tyranny is able to make those thoughts literally unthinkable. And this is what our present tyranny is attempting to do with such topics as race and perversion. They are attempting to force us to think orthodox thoughts and not think anything they disapprove of. By making certain words like nigger and faggot unsayable in public without social and economic retaliation, they impose self-censorship on white Americans. Whites are so afraid of losing their jobs and so afraid of being singled out for social retaliation and demonization for being different, not of the body, so to speak, that whites eventually train their own minds not even to think the word nigger lest they accidentally let it slip and destroy their lives. Now, this is deliberate on the part of the media and the power structure. This is ghastly. It's horrible. It's a form of mental rape, what the liberals are doing to us here. They are destroying our racial identity by forcibly denying us even the vocabulary with which to think forbidden thoughts. Now, that's another reason to use the word nigger, both in your thoughts and in your speech. The use of this and other forbidden words is a form of active resistance. Every time the word nigger or kike or faggot comes out of someone's mouth, a little of the Jews and liberals' mind control is broken down and a little of their power over our lives is eroded. Now, another big objection that some people have is that our use of unapproved racial vocabulary will drive other white people away from the Northwest Front. Well, maybe some. But then the kind of people who are afraid of words aren't the ones we're going to be looking for anyway. Now, the kind of people we need right now are the ones who have been thinking nigger in the privacy of their own thoughts for quite some time now. Our public use of such words is a signal to our own people that, yes, there are others out there like you who do think forbidden thoughts and say forbidden words. When we say nigger, We let other white people, the kind we want, know that they are not alone and that it is still possible to man up and stand up and speak your mind in this country. And believe me, since Obongo and his Jew crew got in, there's some doubt about that in a lot of people's minds. When we say nigger, we are letting our fellow white men and women know that here are some white boys whose minds are not under control, who know the real racial score, and who are not afraid to speak the truth in the face of the enemy. Now, that's an image that we need. A large part of the strength of character we will need to pull this off will come from having the courage to simply stand up and say nigger out loud and damn the consequences. Being truthful and courageous is a habit we need to start cultivating. Some of you may remember the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where King Arthur and his group come across the knights who say neek. Well, this may sound silly at first, but we need to become the knights who say nigger. We can't ask people to rise up against a tyrant's regime if we are not willing to tell them the truth about who we are and about who the enemy is.
Normally, this would be about time for the first music break, but I think instead I'll drop in Fireside Chat number 12 from February of this year, since it has a musical backdrop. Great music on this one. Depressing subject, though.
This is Harold Covington speaking, and the date is February the 18th, 2010. This morning, at around 10 o'clock Central Standard Time, a man named Joseph Stack crashed a light aircraft into the Internal Revenue Service offices in the Federal Building in Austin, Texas. He left behind a long online manifesto, or final communication, in which he described, with great passion and somewhat less coherence, the shafting that, like so many white men of his generation, he received at the hands of the America he was raised to believe in. At the present time, the authorities are only admitting to Stack himself being dead. Looks like the poor bastard didn't even manage to take a single bureaucrat in a suit with him. It's not clear at this point whether Stack had any white racial leanings or not, but his is a condition of mind and soul we can all sympathize with. To quote his own farewell address to the world, he said, "I have just had enough." In this, he speaks for all white Americans, and his willingness to make his point by giving up his own life tells us that, at least, he meant what he said. I've spoken before in my writings of what the radicals of the 19th century referred to as the propaganda of the deed. Well, this was it. Was his act a complete waste? I hope not, but I'm not sanguine about his chances of accomplishing anything. Americans mostly exist on a Beavis and Butthead level. Symbolic gestures like Stack's go right over their heads. But I want to take this opportunity to speak to all of you out there, both men of Stack's generation and mine, and also to young white kids who have been raised under political correctness and who understand that America no longer holds out any hope or any future for them. Time and again, over the past 40 years, I've seen white men snap like this. They go to a shopping mall or a former workplace armed with a couple of semi-autos and they come in the door smoking, or else just go off on a pointless spree, blasting anything black or brown that moves until the cops catch up with him, and either the guy gets shot by the police or else he sticks the muzzle in his own mouth and he blows himself away. I know that right now there are untold numbers of angry white males out there who have been driven to the point of homicidal rage by the terrible injustice, the unfairness, and the tyranny of mind, body, and spirit, which is Obama's America in 2010. I know some of you in the back of your minds are contemplating doing something of this nature. You wouldn't be human if you weren't. I know some of you listening to my voice right now are thinking in your desperation and your righteous rage at the wrongs that America has done to you that going out in a blaze of glory might just be worth it. I'm telling you now, no, it isn't. There are practical reasons why it isn't worth it, not the least being that there's no way you could possibly inflict enough damage on the enemy to justify the sacrifice of a single racially aware white life. There are so few, so terribly few of us, and every one of you is precious to me and to our racial future. If you were able to kill 100 or 1,000 street niggers or Mexicans or federal bureaucrats, the scales still wouldn't balance in our favor. I'm reminded of the words of General George Patton, who said, "Nobody ever won a war by dying for his country. You win by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country." You may reply, "It's my life and I can give it up when and how I want." No, it isn't. Your life belongs to your people and to the moment of history into which you have been born. It is not yours to throw away. The late Pastor Robert Miles once said, "A racist is someone who knows who he is." If you have attained the precious gift of racial consciousness, of knowing who you are, then it is your inescapable duty to use that consciousness to secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. You are not in this for yourself, for your own benefit, or your own private vengeance. There have been ages in the past wherein white men were free to live for themselves and their own desires. This time and place we live in is not one of them. Many of you will have read my Northwest Independence novels, and I want to remind you of what I had a number of my characters say in all four of those books in one form or another. The duty of a revolutionary is not to kill people, but to free people. Our goal is to change the world, and all of our personal lives, actions, and decisions must be subordinated to that objective. Any damn fool can die for his country and his cause. Only a true patriot and a man of honor and integrity can find within himself the strength of character, the self-discipline, and the iron will to live for it. That kind of moral strength and character is what I demand of everyone associated with the Northwest Front, and it is what all of you should demand of yourselves.
I received an email off the website from a guy named Ken, whom I presume lives in Illinois or Indiana, somewhere like that. "Dear Mr. Covington, what about the Midwest? It's the breadbasket of the world and plenty of wide open spaces, just a thought." Okay, this is one we've gone over before, but which I'll be happy to go over again for those of you who came in late. I mentioned this in the past, that a lot of what I say on here is going to involve spaced repetition of a few basic points. I keep getting asked the same questions, and I have to continue to respond with the same answers so that we can begin to slowly, slowly concentrate our weak American attention spans and wrap our mushy American minds around some of these important geopolitical concepts that we've not gotten used to thinking about yet, but which we so urgently need to internalize. Americans generally don't do big picture, but we have to learn. Okay, it is absolutely vital that the white homeland on the North American continent must have an extensive coastline with deep water harbors and access to the outside world. Even in this age of air travel, the bulk of international shipping of everything from petroleum to automobiles and all other kinds of goods is still carried on by sea in container ships. We cannot allow ourselves to be trapped in an enclave of any kind which is susceptible to being blockaded, because A, it's too small, or B, it's landlocked. Ask the people of Gaza how that's working out for them. The very first thing that will happen once the Northwest Republic gains its independence is that the rest of the world will slap sanctions on us to try and starve us into submission and cut us off economically, to punish us for being white and for revolting against democracy and Zionism. This will also mean, of course, that the Northwest Republic will have to immediately concentrate on creating a navy and an air force, possibly even with more emphasis than creating an army. The North was able to effectively blockade and cut off the South during the First Civil War, largely due to the fact that the Southern governing elite was not sufficiently far-sighted to understand and appreciate the need for a Confederate navy. That is a mistake we can't make again. Our other form of response must be to try and create a completely self-contained economy. I've already gone into that topic at some length during past Radio Free Northwests, and so I won't do that again quite yet until someone inevitably asks the question again, in which case we'll have some more spaced repetition on the economy. Okay, now we have a few questions from Steve in Missouri, who contacted me by snail mail at the old post office box that's been closed for a year. And Steve's got a whole list of questions, which I'll paraphrase from those letters I got from him that were forwarded from the old box. A number of letters, actually. First off, do I think that the United States military can be used to establish a white homeland? In a word, no. The rank and file of the U.S. military are by now almost completely non-white or else Beavis and Butthead stupid, or otherwise undesirable, specifically given the military's recent lowering of recruiting standards and the absence of a draft to the point where they're falsifying records and exam scores and knowingly recruiting criminals, drug addicts, gangbangers, the mentally subnormal and unstable, etc., etc. The officer corps of the U.S. military is completely politicized from top to bottom. The few generals who did resist the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, like that guy Eric Shinseki and a couple of others, were simply dismissed out of hand by Jug Ears and his little Jewish friends, and they didn't call out Delta Force or send the tanks into the streets of D.C. They packed up their kit and went quietly like good little soldiers. and for that moral cowardice and weak refusal to stand up to these reptiles who rule us, thousands of their men have died for no reason. If the Pentagon didn't revolt against Billy Boy or Jug Ears, they're not going to revolt against Barry and Rom. Second question from Steve, rather a long one, which, again, I won't quote at length, but it deals with Jewish radio talk show host Michael Savage, who occasionally makes anti-Israel remarks on the air. To cut a long three-page question short, I gather what Steve wants to know is the old question about how about the quote-unquote good Jews, and is there any such thing, in fact, as a good Jew? Well, the answer is yes, Steve. There is very much such a thing as a good Jew, a dead one. Okay, having said that, yes, I know, I myself am guilty of occasional lapses along that line. Every now and then I repost columns by a man in New York named James Howard Kunstler, because some of his economic commentary on the collapse of America is nothing short of brilliant. I've never denied that Jews are capable of extreme brilliance, far more than us, I'm afraid. No one has ever said that they were stupid, just evil. Also, by way of full disclosure, I should note that one of the books I tend to carry around with me through life and leave on my bedside more than not is one called A Distant Mirror, an account of the 14th century in Europe, which is not only the best history book, but one of the just plain best books I've ever read. And it is by a Jewish historian named Barbara Tuchman, who I might add is now a good Jew in the classic sense, i.e. dead. Look, Jews and Jewish things of various sorts permeate this society so deeply and pervasively that it's damn near impossible to avoid them. If you don't believe me, try to eat in America without using kosherized food products. Go to your cupboard and look at all the little U's and K's on your groceries. Everybody occasionally slips into Judaic behavior patterns, including Yiddishisms that have crept into the language. I myself say schmooze and schmuck on occasion. But the idea of accepting Michael Savage or any other Red Sea pedestrian as a quote-unquote good Jew, as in some kind of ally or example or auxiliary, no, never, not done, not happening, no way, Jose. I'll give you a good example. Some time ago, a Jewish revisionist named David Cole made an excellent video about Auschwitz. Being Jewish, he just slapped on his little blue beanie and followed the Polish girl who was the tour guide around the camp with his video camera rolling. As an aside, I've always found that to be one of the tells on Auschwitz. If Auschwitz really was a place where all these terrible things had happened, then presumably even the communist Polish government would have a little bit more sensitivity than to assign some little 18- or 19-year-old girl as a tour guide, like she was showing people around SeaWorld or the crafts fair at Old Williamsburg or something like that. Yeah, this David Cole video was a great expose, and I recommend anybody who can get a copy of it, watch it. It was the first time I'd ever seen the inside of the so-called gas chamber at Auschwitz, and if that doesn't convince you the whole thing is a hoax, I don't know what will. The first thing I noticed was that there are skylights, open windows, in the top of the so-called gas chamber. Cole noticed them as well, and he asked the little Polish girl about them, and she rattles off some spiel about how, when the showers didn't work, the SS men would climb up on the roof and drop cyanide gas grenades down on the Jews in the room through the skylights. I mean, it was just the most absurd thing you ever heard. Good revisionist expose video, no question. And when it came out, Ernst Zundel was especially enthusiastic about it, and he liked it to the point where he and Willis Cardo and some others actually invited this Jew David Cole to attend some revisionist historical conferences. Now, Cardo and I have exchanged a few letters over the years, although I've never been on speaking terms with him, really. But I was on speaking terms with Ernst for many years before he was dragged away and kidnapped by the organs, and I wrote to him and told him the same thing I will say to you folks now. Okay, granted that the Jew did one thing that's good for our cause. Fine, we use it, but we don't invite him to the table, literally. The same thing applies to so-called good niggers, and even more so, I'm sorry to say, to a real problem our movement has with quote-unquote good faggots. If we're going to compromise with Jews or with niggers or with bugger boys to the extent of accepting them into our ranks, at least on a case-by-case basis, and concentrating on whatever their alleged contribution to the cause is rather than what they are, well, there's a name for that. It's called moral relativism or situational ethics. In essence, it is the first hint of taint and corruption, the edge of the slippery slope, the first tinge of those shades of gray wherein the Jew has always thrived. Now, when I was ranting at the secret police last week, I said that one of our greatest strengths and their greatest weaknesses is the fact that we are right and they are wrong. We cannot afford to lose that edge, since it's one of the few we have in our favor. We cannot afford to lose our moral clarity, to start paddling about in shades of gray. That's one of the first methods that the Jew always uses to pry his way into a host society and establish a foothold. He creates shades of gray, zones of moral ambiguity like, say, moneylending in the Middle Ages, which was considered sinful by the church but useful for the economy so everybody turned a blind eye. Or liberal religious tolerance in the 18th and 19th centuries because it was trendy. Or Christian Zionism in the 20th century, so forth and so on. The Jews are the world's greatest builders of trapdoors, escape hatches, whence they can bail out of a cause or a nation or a movement when things become too hot for them. Just like they've largely bailed out of leftism now and gone for neoconservatism. A neoconservatism which has now infiltrated even our own movement. And don't get me started on that or I'll be off like a mechanical rabbit at the dog races. But the presence of Jews in our movement, even in some peripheral capacity, Michael Savage or David Cole or anybody else, is something we can't tolerate, even though I've just admitted I occasionally slip up myself. Well, then you should all strive to do better than me and keep Judaicisms out of your political and personal lives completely. One of those cases of do as I say, not as I do. Another thing Steve from Missouri voices in one of his letters is a complaint that I play too much Irish music and not enough Scottish and English. Well, fair enough. The background to my Joe Stack chat I just played was a Northumbrian pipe piece called Kintail. Now here's the Tannehill Weavers with Gypsy Laddie.
There were three gypsies in a row, and oh, but they were bonny, oh, sang say sweet and say complete, stolen the heart of a lady, oh, laddie, oh. Gypsy laddie, oh. It's chill to have that silken gun and the tallest tartan lady, oh. And you'll come over the sleeling night and follow the gypsy laddie, oh. Not castle seeds come pain a teen, inquiring for his lady, oh. All the hens is run and the hawks is flown and the gypsies are warrior lady, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh. The gypsy laddie, oh, laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh. And suffer to me the black, my case can soon be ready, oh. All meat and drink, I wanna taste, till I get back my he stroked east, he stroked west, and he come into yonder foggy, oh. And there he spied the wind fog made in the arms of the gypsy laddie, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh. With me, my lady, oh, and I swear by the soft times by my side, the black banana shall steal me, oh. I wanna come to you, my honey, and my heart, wanna come to you, my dearie, oh, till I drank to grease the brood and axe in the water of me, oh. Laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh, laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh, laddie, oh, laddie, oh, follow the gypsy laddie, oh, laddie, oh, laddie, oh.
Okay, since this seems to be a bit of a show for bits and pieces, I figure I'll get back to the fireside chats. Again, the reason I'm dropping these short pieces into this RFN is because many of the people who now listen to these podcasts weren't listening a few months ago and haven't heard some of these. Due to the fact that we really are getting a number of new people, more newbies every week, in fact, and most of the people listening to this broadcast have not heard or are not familiar with a lot of our basic stuff, we have to go ahead and we have to do this to bring people up to speed. I try to do this a lot with Northwest Observer, especially, make sure we're all on the same page. Anyway, this is Fireside Chat number 4 from September 14th, 2009.
Hi guys, this is Harold Covington again. This isn't going to be a formal reading from my books or anything. It's just going to be a personal audio letter from me to you folks. I have a special project I can use your help with. Now, normally, as you know, I'm very down on the endless tap, 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 tap of the internet, but I have a project we can all help with, and for which the internet, for once, is perfect. Here's your chance to be of genuine help and without incurring any risk or inconvenience, like the annoyance and inconvenience of actually coming here. So this should get some response. People keep complaining about the difficulties of recruiting and our inability to reach anyone outside of our own small and dysfunctional movement. I've said repeatedly that we need to break out of the bubble and start reaching into the white racial community as a whole, everywhere, but here in the Northwest homeland especially. I've also explained the various reasons why we can't seem to get our act together in actually doing this. Now, we're doing the best we can with the internet, but the primary problem is still that no one knows we are here. A few of you are starting to post our URLs, finally, and hits on both our main sites, Thought Crime and Northwest Front, are slowly inching upward. Thought Crime is now about 600 hits per day, which is the highest it's ever been. Northwestfront.org has broken 100 hits on a couple of days within the last week. But that's still mostly existing movement people as well as niggers and other hostiles, nowhere near what we need to break out of the bubble. The fact is that if the Northwest Front is going to start reaching a mass audience, like it or not, we're going to need establishment media publicity. Now, the fact is that one good newspaper article or one good soundbite on CNN can make millions of people aware of the fact that we exist, reaching more of our racial brothers and sisters in a few words or a few seconds than we could reach on our own in years. Yes, I am aware of all the pitfalls of courting media publicity, but we have to speed this process up. Progress is being made, but it's not being made anywhere near fast enough. We're still not going to be ready, and we may miss our window of opportunity when it comes. Now, the traditional movement way of attracting establishment media publicity is to make fools out of ourselves in public, dressing up in some kind of weird costume and going out in public waving a sign in the air, all six or eight of us, getting stoned with garbage and excrement by hundreds of so-called anti-fascist counter-protesters while the bored and hostile police look at us and occasionally intervene to keep us from actually being stomped to death by the hordes of scum. This is out. I've been there, done that, paid my dues, and we're never going to do that nonsense again. What I need from you people now is your serious, well-thought-out suggestions and proposals as to how the Northwest Front can begin to garner establishment media publicity in, say, 6 months to a year's time, in a responsible way that does not involve us acting like clowns in public and which will not make us look like retarded morons once the editors and soundbite techs get through with us. Try to bear in mind my own personal limitations and also the practical financial limitations we're working under. Sure, I can think of a dozen ways we could get serious publicity, but they all require money, which we don't have. We need to figure out some way that we can get on the front page and on the 6 o'clock news without money, without large numbers of people, and above all, without making public fools and clowns out of ourselves. So think long and hard about this and let me know what you come up with. I'll be waiting to hear from you.
The next audio file I'm going to drop in here is one that I did in October after Jeff Hughes was murdered in Vancouver by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. I apologize for the poor musical background. This was back in the days before I'd been introduced to the WavePad audio software that I now use, and also before I had the editing services of the inimitable Colonel House. So this sounds pretty crude, and on reflection, I might better have left it out. But we just lost a good man, and I figured he deserved at least some kind of epitaph more than my ranting voice. Now, this was done in October 2009, the day after Jeff was gunned down.
Oh, see the 3 foot hosts of men.
This is Harold Covington speaking on October the 25th, 2009. Yesterday morning, Comrade Jeff Hughes was murdered. He was shot down in front of his home in Vancouver Island by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. 10 bullets were fired into his body. This was an execution. The Zionist establishment in Canada found Jeff Hughes to be inconvenient. Jeff opposed his country's infamous human rights tribunals. He publicly attacked Richard Warman, the Jewish attorney who has garnered so much publicity and personal profit from these vile tribunals. He was the head of our sister party, Northwest Front Canada, and he ran a website encouraging white Canadians to migrate and to make their homes in the two western provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. This made him a dangerous man to the elite who control Canadian society. Apparently, someone in authority decided to send us a message. When they murdered Jeff, they told us that white people in North America will never have their own country, that we will never control our own destiny, and that we do not even exist except on their sufferance. Jeff Hughes's killers sought to remove him from among us, to deprive us of his courage, his integrity, and his dedication. They failed. They have forgotten the power and the irresistible inspiration that the blood of martyrs can have within the cause of a people and a nation. In the years of struggle ahead, as we fight to create a homeland here in the Pacific Northwest for all of our folk the world over, Jeff Hughes will be with us in that struggle. They killed his body, but not his spirit. In his name and in the name of all those who give up their lives that our children may someday be free, we will accomplish things that we could never do without the power of that glorious blood of sacrifice that has fallen upon the soil of our land. On that dark Saturday morning, Zion's gun thugs murdered Jeff Hughes, but they did not kill the Northwest Republic. In killing his body, Jeff's assassins ensured the immortality of his name. He is ours now, and we will spend the rest of our lives erecting his monument.
As young Roddy McCorley goes to die on the bridge of doom today.
I find it interesting that of the 18 or 20 audio files I've done in the past year, other than these Radio Free Northwest podcasts, two of them have been about white men who gave up their lives for freedom from Obama and his kikes, Joe Stack and Jeff Hughes. I know this may sound odd and contradictory in view of the fact that I've just tried to convince you in the first part of this podcast that you don't have to be afraid of the organs, at least not afraid to the point of raging paranoia like most of us are. But on the other hand, we should never forget that the price of freedom is blood, and that win or lose, so long as we continue to resist, even on paper and on the internet, there's going to be a butcher's bill. Okay, since there was music of a sort in that file just now, this may be a little bit too soon for another music break, but the sound quality there wasn't so good, and I think we need something to cheer us up after all that depressing stuff. What have I got here on hand? Okay, how about something nice and grandiose and Russian? You know, the Irish and the Russians are actually quite a bit alike. I saw two groups of them get stinking drunk together in a pub in Temple Bar in Dublin once, and believe me, they're pretty simpatico. The Russians even have rebel songs, including this one about a failed revolt against the Tsar that took place in December of 1825. This is the Soldiers' Chorus from the Russian opera The Decembrists by Yuri Shaporin.
So that's cool, yeah.
Okay, now for a quick word on a rather distasteful subject, but one that I have to make clear on occasion. The Northwest mailing list has been growing by leaps and bounds for the past 6 months. I actually had to increase the monthly press run of the Northwest Observer recently in order to accommodate a lot of new names. Now, that list is about to get smaller, significantly so. What happens is that when we get a good, intelligent-sounding inquiry, and it turns out that the individual has sufficient physical courage to give me a name and a mailing address, I send out an introductory packet of party literature. A much smaller one than I used to, because we're getting hundreds of inquiries per month now, and printing and postage costs money. I still use printed matter because it's important for people to get something that they can see and feel and hold in their hand and has some existence outside a computer screen, so they know we're not just an online game of some kind. I understand that a lot of inquiries we get are going to be from Jews and idiots of various kinds who think they're being clever, and even more are going to be from simple, idle curiosity seekers. Okay, I get that. There's nothing wrong with curiosity, and we're willing to satisfy it up to a point. Unlike many right-wing groups, however, we're not willing to keep you on the mailing list forever and a day just because you sent us a nice letter, and that includes email list. Just so you know, it's now halfway through 2010, and I'm going to perform the semi-annual purge of our list. If you have not responded to your introductory pack, and if you have not responded to any further emails from the Northwest Revolution list, or if you have responded with nothing but words, then you're going to be removed from the list. We are a serious political movement, or at least the beginnings of one. And although I admit it's hard to tell sometimes, we are not in the entertainment industry. We have a requirement in the Northwest Front, which I enforce as strictly as I possibly can, that anyone who is affiliated with us must contribute something to the racial struggle besides words. And that can mean dues and financial contributions, yes, although that's not the only way. The requirement, though, is that a comrade of the Northwest Front kick in something concrete and meaningful that helps the struggle to move forward in the real world, and it has to be something besides words on a piece of paper or words on a computer screen. Some of our most important contributors never kick in a dime. They donate time and work and technical skills and serious support for serious real-world projects. If you're not ready to contribute something besides words to the cause of Northwest independence, then we are unwilling to continue to provide you with any extras along the free entertainment line. So for a lot of you, if we haven't heard from you, then you won't be getting any more Northwest Revolutions or Northwest Observers. Sorry, guys, that's the way it has to be. Oh, we're not total Scrooges about it. Sure, you always have my Northwest novels. There's the party's blogs and websites, and there's always Radio Free Northwest. These things are free, and as our media capacity grows in the future, don't worry, you'll get plenty of other freebies as well. But the Northwest Revolution email service, the Northwest Observer magazine, the organizational letters, and all of our internal material is not free. That's for people who respond and who help out and help with something besides words. If you want to know how, email me at nwnet@earthlink.net. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha und den Baden. Freedom.